It was the first time anyone in Europe had ever heard of the Nelson Gallery.
That's the voice of the late Lawrence Sickman, who was a big part of making the Nelson Atkins Museum the internationally known museum it is today. His main contribution? Well, he was fluent in Chinese and fascinated by Chinese culture. So he traveled throughout China in the 1930s, purchasing paintings, sculptures, and furniture. In short, he built the vast collection of Chinese art that now lives here in Kansas City. This is an old recording museum archivists dug up for us. We don't know who he's talking to, but he's describing the process of getting trustees to fund his dream of collecting Asian art.
And so then they began to get a lot of publicity, and they thought, well, why not go ahead, make a big Chinese collection.
Sickman hasn't done too bad with these things, so,
so then we continued on acquiring in the Oriental field.
Rarely seen objects from that Chinese art collection are now on display as part of an exhibit called Emperors, Scholars, and Temples, which made us want to know the story of how a museum in the Midwestern town of Kansas City, in the middle of America, came to have such an extensive collection of Chinese art in the first place. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'd like to welcome Mark Wilson to the show. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Gina. How are you?
I'm good. And it seemed that you knew something we didn't about that recording.
I can tell when it was taken. I can tell what he was talking about.
Tell us.
Well, first of all, it was taken after he had retired. So it's sometime after 1977. And the other voice was that of Mike Churchman, who was doing recordings of Sickman. But what Sickman was talking about was the first time that the Nelson appeared on the international stage. And this is really critical. And he was talking about 1935, 2 years after this museum opened. It had not existed. There had been no building, no collection, no museum. 2 years after it opened, the museum in Kansas City, which many people had never heard of, was actually one of the major contributors to what still is the largest exhibition of Chinese art ever held in the world. And it was the Great Exhibition in London of 1935. And all of a sudden, Kansas City was on the map.
Exhibition? That's what it was. Like a public exhibition?
Oh, it was a public exhibition. It had almost 1,000 items in it. It was the first time that the Chinese government loaned massive numbers of works of art. And they were carried from China to London by the British Navy.
And also from Kansas City?
And also from Kansas City, but under, you know, regular right. ships. It was not the British Navy.
Well, the Nelson now has more than 7,000 works of Chinese mm-hmm. art spanning 5,000 years. Would you say that Lawrence Sickman is the reason we have this collection of Chinese art in Kansas City, or is the answer to that question more complicated?
It's more complicated. First of all, somebody has to set the vision that builds the framework that allows a Lawrence Sickman to work.
Explain what you mean by that.
The vision for what the museum should be. Should it collect Chinese art at all? What the scope of collecting should be? How good should it be? And that framework of intention, those ambitions, the scope of what this museum should be was set by one man, really.
Really? Who's that?
The man who laid out Kansas City, J.C. Nichols.
Really?
Another stroke of genius from Mr. Nichols. He was a trustee. And he and his co-trustee at the time went around the world, literally, looking at museums. And anyone who's been to the Nelson, who's walked into Kirkwood Hall, you see the big black columns there. That's pretty impressive. I love to watch. What I like to watch is, you know, little kids, you know, 6 and 7, they've never been to a museum, never been in a room like that. They come in and you can just see them boogieing in their mind. They're just having a wonderful time. But those columns tell you about the ambition that Mr. Nelson had. This was not to be just a nice regional museum. And it was to collect the works of all civilizations that a great museum of its day, 1930, let's say, would collect.
Well, so
they set that framework for people like, and that we would collect Chinese art. Then they set about getting the tools, and Sickman was one of those tools, and boy, did they get a tool in him.
Yeah, tell me more about him. You knew him personally,
I knew
right?
him very well.
And I mean, talk to me about when you first met. I mean, I want you to set that scene for me. He was the museum's first curator of Asian art starting in 1935. He became the museum director in 1953.
Right.
And then you came along, and at some point you became the curator of Asian art, and then eventually also followed in his footsteps as director. So when did you come into the picture, and
into the picture in 1967. I was going to school on the East Coast, and the Ford Foundation had a program. It was a wonderful program, I would say, that was designed to siphon off promising graduate students into the museum world, not necessarily Asian world, but my field of choice had by then turned out to be Asian art, particularly Chinese art. The Ford Foundation said, well, we think this boy is promising, and so they gave me a fellowship to send me to Kansas City to study one-to-one with Lawrence Sickman, the great dean of Chinese art in the US of A at that time.
Yeah, tell me more about him. What do you know about what motivated him?
All I can say is it's fate and fortune, because he knew from the time he was 7 years old what he wanted to do. And he came from a very interesting family. This is all just like the idea of this collection being here. There's no logical reason. It's someone thinking about this. But he grew up, he was born in Denver, and he started collecting little Chinese trinkets when he was seven, and then went to Japanese prints. And knew what he wanted to do. He wanted to do something that would involve Asian art, particularly Chinese art. He couldn't study Chinese or Chinese civilization at the University of Colorado in Boulder. So he transferred from there to Harvard and started studying. And Harvard had all the great, these great European professors from the previous generation there. So he, and a lot of smart students. And it was a locus of great collectors who would take these students to their houses and say, here, let me train your eye. And that is how he got going.
What's your sense? I mean, when you first encountered this collection and this man who had gotten it underway, what was your impression of not just the size of that collection, but what his choices had been as far as, you know, with all the objects that he might have encountered, why did he pick the ones he did?
Well, part of it was there are two things, and these sound contradictory. On the one hand, remember that the trustees, when they started to build the building, did not own so much as one etching. They didn't get anything from Nelson. So here they decided they were going to have a museum of national and international stature in a place not known for great art collections. There weren't any in Kansas City. So they sent out, we've got to fill up this building. So one hand, the mandate is to buy a lot. And so they bought that big Chinese temple, right? Or the big wall painting. We've got to fill up some space here, guys. The other thing is you want to buy things that matter. Things that matter to people who will come through the doors. Things that will leap off the wall or out of the case and sort of grab hold of you. You've never been to China. All of a sudden, you see this thing, and you say, oh, wow. You mean I've been sharing the planet with somebody who made that, and they're on the other side of the world? So you want that effect, too, the works of art that just have that presence, that aura. And so he was working both sides of that street, and he did it beautifully. He bought tons and tons of things that were not very expensive.
What kinds of things, though?
He bought, this is the other thing that was beautiful about what he did, and he did it better than anybody else did. We all have, at any one time, an art market has preferences, prejudices, fashions, and trends.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's as trendy as anything gets, as we all know. But he avoided the trends and fashions of the Western world, that is to say, what his American and European colleagues would have been buying. And he also avoided the traps of the Chinese prejudices, while at the same time embracing what they considered to be the most important thing. In other words, he didn't let biases get in his way, and he could see the good points of the bias. That sounds crazy.
What guided him, if not a bias? I mean, I understand. Was it his own eye? Was it his own scholarship?
His eye, which had been highly trained by some of the greatest mentors in the United States and in Europe. And it was the eye. He went, and Sickman had training. Let me say, I mean, he had as good a training as anyone of his generation anywhere in the world could have had.
What is something he purchased that you think might have been overlooked by another curator at that time, but that is really a prized object in this collection today?
Oh, well, that was overlooked at the time. It was very unfashionable for, in the Western world, to buy paintings, so-called literati, or paintings by scholars who are not professional artists, but who express themselves through their painting, these literary figures. And they produced, and it was not popular to buy, let's say, 15th, 16th, 17th century painting, which counts as fairly late in the Chinese world, at that time at all. Now, the Chinese liked them, but Sickman was way ahead of the game. Particularly, there's one hand scroll by Shen Zhou, painted in, I think, 1495 or 6, that Sickman bought, along with some other Ming paintings. And it was Sickman who put on, together with a friend of his, Jean-Pierre Dubosc, who put on the first ever literati painting show in the Western world.
And is there not an entire small gallery dedicated to those literati paintings?
We
would call them scroll paintings.
Yeah,
today.
We can call them scroll paintings. Not all paintings are literati paintings. The literati paintings are produced by the upper class, the scholarly class, who's the educated class, and they're also the political class, who run the administration. And they had a very, very rarefied, I mean, most Chinese wouldn't get this, to be honest with you. I mean, this is art by the upper tenth of 1% for that upper one-tenth of 1%. And that's what the Chinese valued. They didn't value Buddhist sculpture. They didn't say, oh, you don't want to collect that stuff.
But we also have plenty of that.
You have plenty of that because that was Sickman bringing the Western view to the Chinese market. The Chinese didn't collect that stuff. That was not art. And if you collected ancient ritual bronzes, which to me have this incredible magic and almost spooky quality, the Chinese would want it because of the inscription on it. Not because it was beautiful or powerful or mysterious, but because of what it told you about the history of the Chinese language.
A lot of people, when they think about the Nelson's collection of Chinese art, just from strolling through the parts of the museum that have that consistently on view, there are a lot of Buddhist sculptures, and I would say notably the Guanyin sculpture. Could you describe that sculpture and tell us about its significance?
Well, first of all, I'm going to turn this around on you a little bit, so indulge me, okay?
Yes, okay.
Okay, when you go into that room.
Okay.
First thing that hits you, of course, it's majestic, it's big, and it's colorful, but it's the gaze.
Yeah, it's a sculpture of...
And that gaze engages you, and pretty soon you're under its spell. Do you feel that?
I do, and I think, just in case
and
our listeners
aren't... That's not the meaning of it, but that's the effectiveness of it. The meaning of it in religious terms, it is the supreme... Every religion has to have a deity that represents and stands for compassion. And in Christianity, we have one called Virgin Mary. Virgin Mary becomes the ultimate deity of compassion. And in Buddhism, Guan Yin or Avalokiteshvara becomes the deity of compassion to whom you, as an individual, let's say you're having tough times of one kind or another, you pray to Guan Yin to intercede on your behalf to bestow boons on you. So these deities of mercy always become very popular, as do deities of wealth. And Guan Yin is a deity of mercy represented, seated on a big, rocky outcropping, carved of wood, leg up, rather relaxed, arm stretched out over the knee, but looking at you with this open stare. And that stare and that composure seems to be have an endless depth. It's as though you're communicating with some kind of cosmic force. And that reaches, and you feel that. And that's why people...
There's a whole room that is essentially an open room left for people to be standing, gathered in front of this sculpture. And I understand that this is internationally kind of a famous Guanyin sculpture.
I would say... Yes, I was going to say it's the most famous, but I mean, that's going out on a limb. But people come from literally from all over the world. And we have benches in the shadows. And you find out if you walk in there and you can say, oh, nobody's here. And then you look behind you and you say, uh-oh, there's somebody. And you don't know except that whatever they're there for is important.
Well, we're going to come right back in a moment when KCOR's Central Standard returns how the Nelson's collection of Asian art more broadly attracted a local scholar to this area. I'm Gina Kaufman. More to come. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we've been talking with Mark Wilson, curator emeritus of the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art and former curator of Asian art there, who picked up on building the museum's Chinese collection, where the infamous Lawrence Sickman left off. Now I'd like to introduce Sherry Fowler, a professor of Japanese art history at KU. Sherry, put the Nelson's Asian collections more broadly in context for us. How significant are these collections?
Well, thank you for inviting me. And they are extremely significant. And I have to say that the Chinese collection at the Nelson Atkins changed my life. That's why I'm here.
Tell that story.
Well, I was in the Gobi Desert and I met my colleague, Marcia Hoffler, and she said, you should come to Kansas. And I thought, wow, okay. But everybody in the field of Asian art knows the Nelson Atkins. It is a major place. In 1966, Jude Sing Lee, who was teaching at the University of Iowa in Chinese art, he came as the first person to teach Asian art at the University of Kansas, and now we have five professors of Asian art, two in Chinese, two in Japanese, I'm one of those, and one in Korean. So Asian art in the Kansas area is really happening. So I came here and was just so pleased to see and be near these things that Mark Wilson has just described. And my area is Buddhist art, so it's a gold mine. when I do field work in Japan and I introduce myself, people say, oh, where are you from? And when I say Kansas, they don't wonder where that is. They say, oh, the Nelson Atkins, because it is so famous.
That's amazing. I mean, were you surprised to discover that when you came to this part of the country, or had you anticipated that as well, being from within this field?
Oh, I knew all about it. As an undergrad, I mean, it was the Chinese collection at the Nelson is in all of the textbooks on Asian art in English. So you see that and you think, oh, I'm from California. Can I go to Kansas? When I was an undergrad, I was driving across the country and it was Monday and the museum was closed. I was brokenhearted because I really wanted to see the Guanyin. And I didn't get to see that until I came for my job interview at KU. And of course, they escorted me over there and take a look. And I, woo, this is so fantastic. I wanted to be part of that. And we do at KU make wonderful use of the collection. We bring our students over and have field trips and have a really nice relationship with that. So
when you
it's very important to us.
Yeah, when you say that the Nelson's art objects are in the textbooks for Asian art and Buddhist art in particular in the U.S., what images other than one of the Guanyin, which we've been talking about, are there other objects that have similar kind of standing within the Asian art history world?
Oh, many. Of course, that's on the cover of some of the textbooks. But there are some of the paintings that Mark Wilson was just talking about, some of the ink paintings from the 10th to 13th century are really well known, and they're just so marvelous, and it's an amazing opportunity to have those in the area. Now, they're not up all the time because they're light sensitive, but they do come out, and we're very thrilled to see them when they do. So there are, you know, everyone thinks about the Guanyin because it is set in that marvelous stage with the temple around it and everything and the mural. But there's a whole other room of wonderful stone sculptures, Buddhist sculptures.
Yeah, you have to not sway too much in that room.
not just way too much. Well, you might faint if you're really excited about it. And not too long ago, the room was painted purple. So the white, the luminescent sculptures just stand out. It's really gorgeous.
When you talk about Buddhist sculpture within the museum, I'll get back to Chinese very specifically in a moment, but there is a Japanese sculpture in the stairwell that I think most people who have visited the museum and passed it are struck by, partly just because of its enormous size. It's an Amida Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about the giant Buddha sculpture seated, you know, cross-legged, appearing to be gold.
Yes, he almost has his own room. He's so large, and people love to go over and pose in front of him. That's a nice sculpture. It's really large, and that's one of the exciting things about it. But I really want to encourage the listeners to look next door. There's a marvelous Kannon sculpture right next to it, but you don't see that if you walk directly into the room. You have to look to the right. And that is a nice 9th century piece that is the same Buddhist deity as the Guanyin, only in Japanese we call it Kannon. And that's a really nice one. And then across from the big Buddha is another one of 10th century Jizo Bodhisattva, who is also compassionate. He looks like a monk, and he's carrying a little pole with him. And that's a really marvelous sculpture. So they're kind of to the side, and people don't often notice them, but they're definitely worth a look.
Sherry, what do you think is different about the Nelson's Asian collections that makes it this destination?
Well, you don't just have one or two things. I mean, it's a whole world. There are all kinds of things out to see, so you can go from different rooms and get a sense, as Mark Wilson was saying, about the bronzes, the sculptures, and then there's a special painting room. And the painting room has things that they need to be changed all the time because of their the light sensitivity. But when you walk in there, the light will come on so you can take a look at the painting. So if nobody's in there, the light's off. It's good for preservation. And that's another special experience.
So it's partly not the collection itself. It's partly also how much of it is on view.
Yes. So that's right. But because it changes, that gives you a reason to go back again and again.
Mark Wilson, I'd like you to respond to some of what you've heard.
Well, I think what you may have divined from what Sherry has said is the museum has, in these areas of Chinese painting, Japanese prints, Chinese textiles, Chinese ceramics, and a number of other areas of Asian art, great works of art that it can't, for one reason or another, show. So years and years ago, we tried our best to figure out a way, how am I going to let people see these? I don't need to borrow works of art from London or Tokyo. We've got them right here.
In storage.
In storage. So we do exhibitions drawn from storage. And that's what's on display now. It's an exhibition that takes three different approaches. One from the perspective of the court, which had its own artistic workshops. You know, they made furniture at the court. They made lacquer. Of course, they may have their own jade workers. Their own glass makers. And it's a totally different thing, totally different perspective on art. And then you have the scholar's perspective and so forth. But one of the things is to make sure that you get out at any one time the things people expect to see. And that's really important. The Nelson has this fabulous, the number one collection in the US of A. And I can say that right now because we just got a bequest of two pieces that pushes it to number one of Chinese furniture. Well, you really owe it to the public to have that stuff on display. And yet you can't always display all the things because they're light sensitive, as Sherry has been
pointing out. And because there are 7,000 of them.
And because there are 7,000. Now, let me say, not all 7,000 are worthy of your attention. Okay. Museums, and this is going to sound, I think museums often have too much stuff in them, quite frankly. And that they would most of them benefit by editing.
But do you think that you end up with as many things that are worth seeing if you don't collect that rigorously?
I think you can. The example being Cleveland has collected very, very rigorously for decades and decades, almost its entire existence, and it's just the most fabulous experience because you're going after one killer after the next. You just go down and around the room and you say, wow.
But I want to get back to this, how we have the things we have in Kansas City.
It's luck. Because if you just took, Gina, let's just take the odds. What were the odds that a great national caliber museum would grow up in Kansas City? That the Nelson would be something other than a regional museum? The odds weren't very good. If, let's take this then from another perspective. Why does Kansas City have these great Asian collections when San Francisco, with an Asian population, had none whatsoever until the 1960s when a Chicagoan named Brundage gave them his collection?
Please answer that.
Please answer. There is no logic, you see. The logic, it goes back to those first trustees who set the scope.
And then found a Lawrence Sickman.
Yes, and they found a Lawrence Sickman. And there was their good luck. That they set the scope was a matter of intelligence, rational behavior. They picked the Boston Museum of Art to be the model, and that was critical. Picking the Boston Museum of and the connection to Boston, because that's where they got some of their advisors to help them build the collection from that Boston-Harvard fog connection. And Sickman, of course, was, and their first advisor for Chinese and Japanese art was Langdon Warner.
I want you to describe one thing in this collection of Chinese art that that isn't one of the things people flock to see, that isn't one of the things everybody loves, but that is something that you think is extraordinary and that makes this collection stand out to you personally.
Okay. Let's go into the purple room, as Sherry called it.
Yes, let's.
Okay. We go into the purple room, you make a hard right, and there's a very plain, almost severe stone image about 5.5 feet high. And it doesn't call attention to itself. At first, it might look so plain that we would call it severe. There's not a lot of fancy drapery. It's almost like a column. The features are pretty simple. It's kind of abstract, actually. But if you, the more you look at it, the more you look at it, the more you say, oh my God, this is the most spiritual thing I think I've ever seen. And this is the best combination of cross between abstraction and realistic depiction. And that's one of them for me. That's my favorite.
Mark Wilson, Director Emeritus of the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, thank you so much for sharing this story with us. And Sherry Fowler is with us from KU's Art History Department. Thank you, Sherry.
Thank you. That was my choice too, Mark.
Good, Sherry.
The Yay. Emperor's Scholars and Temples exhibit is on view at the Nelson through July of this year. Be sure and check it out. Up next, how childhood sports and activities come back to haunt us later in life. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. And now, how the activities we do as kids to learn discipline or make friends or get exercise come back to us in unexpected ways as adults. Maybe you've got an uncle whose ankles pop and he's always attributed that to his days as a wrestler, or a cousin whose knees are going out and she's always saying it's because she was a catcher for the softball team. This morning's guests are going to help us understand how our bodies carry our histories with us, whether we notice it or not. Amanda Grimes, with us from the UMKC School of Nursing and Health Studies. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
So you teach about the body, but you used to be a gymnast, right?
Correct. Uh-huh.
Talk to me about your history with that sport.
I started about when I was 10, which is actually kind of late for a gymnast, but very competitive gymnast going through high school and then competed in college as well. So my body definitely took a little bit of a beating through those years.
Explain that, because people who haven't done gymnastics might wonder how it is that gymnastics beats up a body. I mean, football is getting a lot of press these days for the potential damage it can do to a young body, but what about gymnastics?
Sure. A lot of high landings, you know, you pick up quite a bit of speed doing flips and get up several feet in the air and come down on padded surfaces, but they still are fairly hard whenever you're landing for competition. and of course falls on the beam. The beam and the bars are not forgiving if you hit those. And even taking some falls from above the high bar. So high bar may be 8 feet high. You're on top of that, and then you can fall off that bar and come down pretty hard. So hopefully you're always landing on a mat, but they are pounding.
As someone who does health studies now, I mean, what is your current understanding of what physiologically was happening to your body when you were taking all of those hard landings?
It's a little out of my expertise, but you definitely felt the repetitive landings and all those things. And a lot of my work now is more so trying to get people to exercise and figure out those adaptations and how can they still move and get that physical activity even if
they've been through something
right,
that was hard on their body.
Yeah.
I mean, what kinds of activities do people coming to you carry with them? So like when you meet people who are needing to adapt their adult behavior, their adult movements, are there sort of recurring childhood activities that people have done that you say, oh my gosh, this always does this?
I don't have a lot of experience with perhaps that situation, more just personal experience. But you definitely hear a lot of knee injuries, back injuries in adults that may be contributed from childhood going forward. But looking for those exercises that are lower impact, like cycling or an elliptical or something like that, that could be continued on.
We'll turn to Trent Herta for this. He's with us from the Department of Health, Sport, and Exercise Sciences at KU. Trent, what's your take on that? I mean, what are some examples of things that we might do as a child that we think this is the most innocuous activity I can imagine, but yet some sort of repeated movement leads to difficulty later on?
Yeah, I think any repetitive movement, particularly to the joints, we're not giving us enough time to recover. I think the obvious one is the throwing motion with baseball. Young pitchers tend to have elbow and shoulder problems if they throw too many pitches as a youth and don't give themselves enough time to recover. I think other types of activities we don't think about, one we don't think about is runners. Young runners who don't give themselves time to recover and run too many miles per week will tend to have stress fracture issues as they age.
How do they recognize that they've got a stress fracture issue?
Well, it starts with pain, and usually the fracture is there, the stress fracture is there before the pain, but then it gets diagnosed through x-rays or, you know, by a physician. I think the problem with the runners are, once the runners are pain-free, guess what runners want to do?
They want to run.
They want to run, and they want to get back to the mileage that they were before the stress fracture, and that tends to be a big problem.
What about, like, you know, violinists? I mean, they move their wrist in a very predictable way. Can you have lingering effects from even playing musical instruments?
Yes, absolutely. There's a lot of research that shows violinists have problems with their wrists and elbows as they're older, especially ones who start before age 5. One of the other research says, you know, violinists who start before the age of 5 are actually better. So they're taking on a risk starting so young, but they tend to be the better violinists when they're older. But yes, they all have problems.
We've got another guest in the studio this morning. Gary Abbott is with us from the UMKC Conservatory of Music and Dance. Hi, Gary.
Hello. How are you? It's good to see you. I listen to you every day. Now I can see your face.
Well, it's nice to see you, too, even though I don't listen to you every day. Gary, what's your history with movement and how your own body carries that history?
I am one of the dancers that started late in life. I didn't start really dancing until I was 19. But I grew up in an era, the late 50s, 60s, and part of the 70s, where in Atlanta, I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, wasn't as developed as it is now. So I did all of the boy stuff. I ran around, played baseball, played football. In high school, I was a runner, and I loved running. I loved cross country. And then I discovered dance at 19, and I knew that's exactly what I wanted to do. And mostly because of the physicality of it, even though I didn't do any kind of sort of focused stuff as a child, I love physical movement. I love to move.
Do you find that as someone who ran when you were younger, mm-hmm. but then danced at a really high level,
mm-hmm.
do you think that the running has stayed with you in ways that maybe the dance?
Absolutely. It's the absolute opposite. At this moment now, I'm 60. Dun, 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 dun. And so running is not necessarily that great for my knees now. My knees are probably the first place I start feeling the age in my body. Even though I'm still pretty active, I feel the pain in my knees now. Actually, running prepared me for the endurance that it took to be a dancer and to study at such a focused sort of intense sort of way.
So that's the other side of this, is that the activities that we do mm-hmm. as our bodies are growing up, I mean, we carry that activity with us, not just in the form of injury, but in terms of benefits mm-hmm. as well. I mean, you're talking about that running from a young age built your endurance. Can you describe that a little more?
Well, I started off as an African dancer. And as most people who take African dance know, it's constant. It'll last from an hour and a half up to 3 hours sometimes. I've even taken a four-hour class. And so my endurance, my body got stronger and stronger the more I danced, the more I built up the endurance again to get through. And so when I would be in rehearsals and I would have to repeat dances over and over again, it would be pretty easy for me, yeah. Sometimes I would, of course, like I'm normal, I'm not Superman yet, but, you know, I would get that little moment of being tired. But, you know, it prepared me to be able to repeat work over and over.
What about you, Amanda? I mean, did gymnastics instill you with certain things that you think affect how your health and well-being and your body work in a positive way?
Definitely. I still, to this day, it feels weird if I go a handful of days in a row without doing some kind of workout. You know, from a young age of 10, you were working out 5, 6, sometimes 7 days a week for 3 or 4 hours at a time. And so just having that feeling my entire life, to this day, it feels really weird if I would drop off from that. But gymnastics is definitely not a sport that you carry on throughout your entire life. So I had a great coach in college that was like, ladies, you can't do this forever. You need to figure out other activities that you can actually carry on through life. And so he was big into cycling and running and instilled that in several of us. Mm. So cycling and running kind of has turned to my go-to activities now.
I guess part of what I'm thinking about is that, I don't know, for me, I did ballet for a long time as a kid, and a lot of people in my family have had to have back surgery and have had serious back problems that have never plagued me, even though I assume that I have the exact same physiology that all of them have. And I have started to think, you know, it could be the constant work on posture and the constant need to self-correct that ballet forced on me for so many years. Mm-hmm. Trent, what do you think about that?
Yeah, that's a good point. You likely ballet was strengthening those muscles that the other family members weren't participating in activities that would strengthen those muscles that would be used later in life. There are certainly a number of sports that are not good on the back, but ballet might be one that is strengthening the core area that's going to help you later in adulthood. Yeah.
Do you see other examples of activities that do that kind of thing, that's not the reason you're doing it? I mean, you're playing the violin because you want to play the violin. You're playing tennis because that's fun for you or whatever, but that have benefits that are very specific and physiological later in life?
I do think running, we did talk about some of the injuries that can come with running when you run maybe too much than you can handle. But I think certainly running, in Gary's experience, is going to help in a cardiovascular function throughout a life. And also any sport, and not just a sport, but the conditioning for the sport. When you're in there and trying to make yourself stronger to make you better for the sport, strength is a big player in how we function later in life. So if you're participating in basketball, typically part of basketball is going to be some strength training. Huge, huge benefits to strength training. That's going to help you as an adult.
Do you recommend, I mean, when you look at something like the debate over football, do you see
other sports that you think, sports or any kind of activity where you think, yeah, but people should be paying attention to this?
Other than football?
Yeah.
Oh, I think baseball for sure. The throwing motion that we do is just unnatural. It's something we probably shouldn't be doing, but we're going to keep doing it because that's what we've been doing for 100 years.
What is it about that motion that's unnatural?
Our anatomically speaking, our arm just does not like to be moved through that, go through that movement repetitively. The shoulders and the elbows, we kind of we snap at those joints while we throw a baseball, and we do that. And the other thing about baseball is, like, you do that movement often without enough recovery. It's really going to break down the tissues around the elbow and the shoulder.
Gary, it looks like you've been relating to some of what Trent's been saying.
I was listening because I think the key to really any type of sports activity that you get into, dancing, gymnastics, baseball, the most important thing for me is that you have to have a really good coach, a really good instructor, someone who knows about the body and someone who cares about what your body and
who cares about your body and not just your performance.
Exactly, exactly. And who's looking down the road at what it could possibly do to you, the effects that it can have on you, and teach you a ritual of warming up, preparing before you do it, what happens after you finish, should you sit down, stand up, you know, drink, whatever, you know, that's important.
You are around dancers, you know, kind of coming into the program there at UMKC all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Do you encounter dancers who haven't had that kind of background and who have, where that shows?
I absolutely have, you know, and dance is a passion. You know, oftentimes you learn about the passion and you react to the passion before you react to the physics of it. Oftentimes I'll see teachers who are not necessarily passing the information along as well as they should be. They have the passion and they have the desire to do it. But then I'll get the kids in and it'll take a little while, a year or so, to really get them into some sort of ritual where they can actually know what's really, really going on with their body, what's going on with their core, what's going on with their everything, their ankles, you know, how to stand properly, how to make sure that you are working in a very rigorous but smart way. Yeah.
You know, Trent, we've been talking about the fact that repeated movements of any kind will sort of eventually wear you down if you're not doing them correctly. Why is that? I mean, can you explain physiologically what's happening there?
I don't know if it's even if we're doing movements incorrectly, to be honest. We're putting a stress on a tissue. Anytime we put any stress on any tissue, it needs time to recover. Even things like pipetting in a lab. People who pipette all day, every day, we've researched.
So that's when you're kind of like taking a liquid with a little dropper and then undropping it?
Yep, and you use your thumb. So we have this fancy pipetters that is supposed to be ergo-friendly and really help with your thumb. But at the end of the day, if you're doing that all day, every day, and not giving those tissues of your thumb to recover, you're going to have problems.
So, but what is it that's I would think that motion is almost exactly what's happening when we're using our thumbs on our cell phones over and over again. I mean, are we even just in our everyday behavior at this point kind of doing exactly what you've described?
The thumb and the cell phone is interesting. So I also think about, it is possible that could lead to problems in the future. We just don't know them yet. I know there's a lot of focus now on touching. Constantly sliding our fingers across screens repetitively might not be a great thing either. We could be damaging the sensories at the tips of our fingers.
Yikes.
I know.
So Amanda Grimes, you do work with people trying to help them find ways to adapt activities so that their bodies will kind of survive those activities intact. I mean, what do you think about these kind of everyday activities that are such a part of our life now? I mean, do we need to be finding adaptations not just for gymnastics, but also for how we use our cell phones?
Yeah, I don't have much experience from that. That's the first I've heard of that with sliding our cell phones and stuff. But
Yeah, I mean, things that we're not used to doing and all of a sudden doing them all the time can definitely lead to problems. And one we're seeing everyday activity is sitting. And so we're seeing that inactivity and sedentary lifestyles are, you know, becoming the new smoking, and that they lead to just as many issues and tight hips and backs that we're seeing with other things. So I think we start needing to start think about adaptations for just sitting all day at work. How can we get up? Do we need standing desks? Things like that.
Exercise is obviously really important, but we're also hearing that sometimes the repetitive activity of a sport that you're passionate about or an activity that you just love can leave its effect on a body, and, sure, and not always a good effect, though sometimes. But how do you advise people and also parents who are thinking about their kids' activities to approach those things they're passionate about, without wrecking themselves?
Sure. I think cross-training is a thing. So utilizing other sports, other training methods that don't have that same impact on your body that you're doing every day. So even as a gymnast, we would swim once a week instead of doing some kind of pounding workout, so that we just switched up those body joints that we were using, but still, you know, working ourselves cardiovascularly and using our muscles and going through full range of motion, but not having that same pounding effect. So kind of cross-training and trying some other activities that are still working you, but not having that same repetitive motion.
Gary, for you, I mean, you picked up dance later in life. Do you think that in some ways you benefited from not doing it from such a young age?
I wish I had started younger. I really do, because I love it. Any sort of passionate thing or passionate and physical thing that you do will leave impact on your body. And that's one of the things that's just natural. For me, I think knowledge around everything that you learn, everything that you do, reading about it, making sure that you're getting proper training is very important.
Trent, you were saying earlier that the violinists who start before they're 5 years old end up being some of the best violinists, but also have the highest risk for wrist and elbow injuries. And we're hearing Gary saying that he wishes he had started younger. I mean, it seems like it's kind of a double-edged sword that the body is formed around these specific activities that you engage in, for better or worse, but that a late start isn't just going to save you some injuries. It might also prevent you from being formed in the right way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, who was it, the 10,000 hours of work is necessary to be great. I think that was, they're speaking to violinists, actually. So some sports, if we talk about sports, I think wrestling is a good one, where if you're thinking about being an Olympian, you got to be doing it at age 7 or 8. There are other sports where specialization, which we would call, someone, a youth, practicing it over and over and only participating in that sport, which I think maybe we see a lot, like in AAU basketball, isn't necessarily a means to get that scholarship or get to the NBA or get to MLB or get to the NFL, where actually those athletes typically come from families or backgrounds where they're playing multiple sports at a youth and they're not specializing in one sport like maybe a violinist is. But yes, there are some sports where specialization is important to become the best, but there's others that are not, so parents need to look into that.
We've been staying away from football and concussion, but Kansas City football fans are probably very excited about that sport right now. So on our way out, just what do you think of how football affects the body overall, not just the head?
The knees are the big one. The joints of the lower body. Major damage to the joints of the lower body can occur. If they do occur, it's going to leave us less functional as we age. It'll be tougher to stay physically active, so there's going to be other problems like cardiovascular fitness and body composition issues that likely will come up.
Dang, sorry, football kids.
Not all of them, though.
Trent Herta, Amanda Grimes, Gary Abbott, thank you all so much for talking to us about how the body works with these activities that we are obsessed with as kids.
Thank you for inviting me.
You can listen back to both of this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, with inaugurations in the air, we'll talk about how the Electoral College affects Midwesterners' voice in the national political scene. Plus, the character of the chef inspired by Jennifer Maloney. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Suzanne Hogan, Andrea Tudhope, and Jen Chen. I'm Gina Kaufman.